We're going to talk about, for me, one of the most difficult things in the world to talk about and actually do. But I want to think about difficult things. So I want to ask, let's start with this. What's the difficult thing, most difficult thing about being an adult? There's no wrong answers here. Responsibility. Taxes. How do you say that? You're like 16. What's that?
Budgeting.
Ugh.
Children.
Job. What's the most difficult thing about your job?
Going
to it. People. It's going to be a long week for some of you. Any more?
Deadlines.
Sure. What's the most difficult thing about being a student? There's a handful of you in the room. Yeah.
Homework.
Duh. Yeah.
Other students.
We are such a loving, people-friendly church here. Yeah.
Finals.
But here's what I love about finals is when they're over, it's over. And so, like, I'll just speak from pastoral world, it's never over. Yes, ma'am.
P.E.?
Did you say P.E. as the most difficult thing about school? All right. I think that's my kid's favorite. Yeah.
Waking up.
Yes, he speaks from experience. What's the most difficult thing about living in Central Illinois?
Weather.
Unanimous. By the way, can I just say, this is, by the way, like maybe the best time of the year, because even with the doors closed this morning and windows closed, although we had our windows open a couple nights ago, but anyway, if you're up early enough, the sound of the birds, like the birds are back. And I noticed the other day I was doing yoga downstairs and I had the window, like the slider open, and I was just watching the robins bounce around the yard, and there's one of them that's super fat, and I know she's building a nest under our deck somewhere. But regardless, it was really like, oh yeah, that's the best part about it. What else? What's hard about living in Central Illinois? Yeah.
The potholes.
Amen. The potholes. No kidding.
It's flat.
It's flat.
There may be a thing or two wrong with the government.
If you didn't hear that, there may be a thing or two wrong with the government.
Taxes.
Bugs. What's the most
what?
Traffic. Oh, I think that's one of the best things about Peoria. There's no traffic. What's the most difficult thing? When you start thinking about being a follower of Jesus, what's the most difficult thing about that?
Going against the grain.
Going against the grain?
Other followers.
Other followers of Jesus. You both said it at the same time. That's amazing. You guys know this is on Facebook, right? Just making sure you all know that's what's happening.
Boy, I want to go to that Imago Dei church. They don't like the people they work with. They don't like the people they go to school with. They don't even like each other.
Yes. Anybody else?
Interpretation.
Interpretation. Yeah, everybody's got one, don't they? Yeah, David. Wow, lots of hands.
Dying to self.
Dying to self.
Consistency.
Good. Consistency.
Failing.
Yeah.
Others' expectations.
Ugh. How about loving your enemies? Boy, Danny, well, you looked ahead, huh? What are you going to say? And then
Others' assumptions.
Last fall, I think it was September or October, I spoke at United Presbyterian here in town. My friend Stephen McKinney Whitaker had left and moved to Hershey, Pennsylvania. And they just need a pulpit fill for a week. So it's kind of fun. It's fun, in case you don't know this. It's fun for, like, just to go into a place and you can just say whatever you want because, you know, what are they going to do, not have you back? Oh, well. And often in those situations, they just say, like, you can talk about whatever you want to talk about. And so it's kind of fun because I can tell all the stories that I've told repetitively here and they're all new and my jokes are funnier there. And so... So I chose to speak on this idea because I think it was Anne Lamott I read years ago who she said the most difficult part about following Jesus is forgiving other people. That is the if you boil all the teachings of Jesus down, and for me, That rings true to me. That of all the things Jesus taught, and he teaches a lot of things, and I think it probably relates to what you said, Dave, about dying to self. Forgiveness is, to me, easily the hardest part about what it means to be a Christian. And I think Anne Lamott actually went on to say that that is the defining hallmark of what it is to be Christian, is that we are a people who chooses forgiveness over revenge. And so much about who we are, I mean, anybody have any revenge fantasies? Anybody had any revenge fantasies in the last year, too? Can we get back, like, right? Like, that's just, like, part of the DNA of what it is to be human, where somebody wrongs us, and we just want to make sure, and we don't necessarily have to be the ones that, like, mete out the revenge. I don't have to be the one to do it. I just want to see it happen, right? And so this idea of loving our enemies is just really, I just think it's really hard. So I want you to turn your Bibles to Matthew chapter 5, and let's read together. Matthew 5, verse 38. And I'm reading from the Message, so it'll be a little bit different. Here's another old saying that deserves a second look. Eye for eye, tooth for tooth. Is that going to get us anywhere? Here's what I propose. Don't hit back at all. If someone strikes you, stand there and take it. If someone drags you into court and sues for the shirt off your back, gift wrap your best coat and make a present of it. And if someone takes unfair advantage of you, use the occasion to practice the servant life. No more tit for tat stuff. Live generously. So how does that sit? When you read that, because that's familiar. This comes from Jesus' Sermon on the Mount early in Matthew 5, 6, 7. How does that sit with you when you hear that? What thoughts come to mind? It seems like a good idea, but not something we want to do. Almost like something we might applaud other people for. Like that Gandhi, that Martin Luther King, they were really good at this. That's pretty admirable for them. I'm glad there's people that live like this. Yeah, Karen.
It's anti-everything in our Western culture.
It's anti-everything in our Western culture. And I would even pick on, I would take the word Western out of it. Because you can just go culture to culture, and it's antithetical to... Do you guys ever remember this movie? And it's been years, and I kept thinking about it this week as I was preparing. It was called The End of the Spear, and it was about the Alca Indians in Ecuador. Thank you. Yeah, in Ecuador, which is the Indians that killed Jim Elliott years ago. That's going to be a whole other tangent. I'm not going to go on. But it talked about that culture was based on, you do me wrong, and I'll do you wrong plus one, and how that... You just, and it doesn't matter. It's not just Western culture. It's all cultures that, given our own devices, like that's where we go. What else?
Maybe it's just me, but it's easier to forgive something that when you've been wrong versus when somebody you love has been wrong.
Mm.
And I was having a conversation with a friend this week, and her child, somebody else.
Yeah. Yeah. It's easier to forgive a wrong towards me, but mess with my kids. You know, like it incites something in us for sure. Yeah. Danny.
I can be on board with the whole, you know, violence thing and taking that. But as far as giving up more needs when somebody else.
Yeah.
This isn't a once.
Yeah. Giving up your needs for somebody else that is your enemy. Yeah, that's huge. Any other thoughts? Eventually, yeah. Yeah, it does. I think that's true. When we, anybody had that experience, like it's hard to get there, but there is something about letting it go that actually feels good out there. But getting there is really hard work. Yeah, I think that's true. Yeah. Oh, yeah, like they don't respond the way you wish they would respond. Yeah, oh, totally. I'm going to come back to that idea because I think that's huge. Yeah.
That's exactly what I was thinking. A lot of times I end up feeling like a doormat.
Yeah. Yeah, you end up feeling like a doormat for sure. Yeah. Yeah. It is harder, for sure. Yeah. Yeah. It's hard when the person is a repeat offender, for sure. And when I've done this talk before, we've talked about, like, there's boundaries too, right? Like, I can forgive somebody, but that doesn't mean I have to give them the right to hurt me again. And there's for sure boundaries to that. And forgiveness doesn't mean I let you hurt me, right? Yeah. It means I let go of the desire for revenge. So just so you know, we've talked about this idea lots and lots. So as I've been working the last week, last 2 weeks or so, Friday I worked on my manuscript for next Sunday. And so I've been really thinking back through the life of the church, and Kevin sent me 177 photos yesterday. No, it's awesome. It was awesome. And so I was looking through pictures and all that stuff and thinking, like, I've taught on this a lot. And in fact, I went back, because I keep things like this. I went back, and does anybody know the very first series we did at the church? It was a Sermon on the Mount. We started with the Sermon on the Mount. So on May 11th of 2008, which was Mother's Day that year, I taught on this passage. And it's one of only a very few number of passages I've taught more than once over 10 years. So I want to tell you what I said then, and then I'll move past it. So at the time, there was a popular preacher who said this about Jesus. So he said, some emergent types want to recast Jesus as a limp-wrist hippie in a dress with a lot of product in his hair who drank decaf and made pithy Zen statements about life while shopping for the perfect pair of shoes. In Revelation, Jesus is a prize fighter with a tattoo down his leg, a sword in his hand, and the commitment to make someone bleed. A commitment to make someone bleed. This is a guy I can worship. I cannot worship the hippie diaper halo Christ because I cannot worship a guy I can beat up. What's that? I'm not saying who it was. Yeah, it was. And so at the time, this was really big. Like, this pastor had said this, and I asked us as a church to really think about which Jesus are we following, because he started contrasting two kinds of Jesus. And talking about specifically this passage, I talked about this idea of what does it mean, a commitment to make someone bleed. And we in that service, I don't even think the audio exists anymore, but we went back and talked about, like, what does that mean and which Jesus are we going to follow, and really kind of defining who we are as a church. And I talked about the myth of redemptive violence. Anybody want to say what that means? See if you remember that from 10 years ago. Anybody? Yeah. Right. Violence doesn't get you peace. Violence gets violence. When you solve a problem with violence, it just invites more violence. And so I ended, not I ended, but these are just, there was more slides than this. These are just the four I took out of the middle. I had this quote then: the demonic sirocco of violence is fed by illusion of ultimate righteous victory. Any peace achieved by violence is a peace forever threatened by violence, thus ensuring that the bloody game will be perpetuated. So I put all those up there to say, 10 years ago, we were talking about this passage, and I could have just given this message again, honestly, this morning. It'd have been easy just to give this one again. But what's happened in 10 years, I think, is that this has mostly just become the DNA of our church. I think if I taught this message again, nobody would be surprised which Jesus we're talking about. And that we've really, as a church, really tried to embrace this idea of what does it mean to love our enemies, and what does it mean to forgive, and all the things that those things entail. And to the point where even some of our music over the years, one of the songs we did this morning that Jeff wrote had that language in it, that we've owned that language. That's become part of the DNA of Imago Dei Church, which makes it harder to give a message because it's like preaching to the choir. And then for me, I always love, let me finish this part out and then I'll pivot. What I always love then is that Jesus didn't just teach about this idea of loving his enemies, but then, to me, this is probably one of my favorite moments in the Passion narrative, where Jesus looks down from the cross at the soldiers gambling for his garments and says, forgive them, they don't know what they're doing. That Jesus has the presence of mind in the midst of his own execution to think about the people at the foot of the cross who are crucifying him, and can think about their perspective in it and pronounce forgiveness on them, because he has the capability and the presence of mind to think that they might be thinking and how they might be processing, and then to absolve them. And I mean, I would love that, right? Like, I would love to have the ability within the context of my life that when somebody does something that hurts me, whether it's intentional or unintentional, that I would have the presence of mind to think, to transcend that moment and to say, like, well, they're just speaking out of their own pain, and so I absolve them of this, right? If you are that person, I'm going to sit down and you can just jump up and preach any moment, right? Because I feel really inadequate to that, because that's not, I'm not there. And maybe you are, but that's pretty incredible. And I love that. And I love that Jesus' words and actions all kind of go together, and it makes for a really good sermon. The problem is that when we were talking about this sermon back in December, January, in the formation team, we actually went a slightly different direction. Because I actually think that this beginning part, I think this idea of forgiving our enemies is the beginning part to a much harder thing, to a much, much harder thing, actually. And I want you to look in your passage. We're just going to go up the passage to verse 21. And it says this: "You're familiar with the command to the ancients, 'Do not murder.' I'm telling you that anyone who is so much as angry with a brother or sister is guilty of murder. Carelessly call a brother idiot, and you might find yourself hauled into court. Thoughtlessly yell stupid at a sister, and you are on the brink of hellfire. The simple moral fact is that words kill." I love the message right there, by the way, right? The simple moral fact is that words kill. Nothing hurts as much as the things that people say. "This is how I want you to conduct yourself in these matters. If you enter your place of worship and about to make an offering, you suddenly remember a grudge a friend has against you, abandon your offering, leave immediately, go to this friend, and make things right. Then and only then, come back and work things out with God. Or say you're out on the street and an old enemy accosts you. Don't lose a minute, make the first move. Make things right with him. After all, if you leave the first move to him, knowing his track record, you're likely to end up in court, maybe even jail. If that happens, you won't get out without a stiff fine." I think it's like level one. And hear this, please. I think it's the hardest thing Jesus teaches, to love your enemies. And that's level one. Because level two is actually to go make peace with my enemies. That I take the initiative and I go out and forgive my enemies. It's one thing to sit back and say, well, I'll forgive them when they come to me and seek out the forgiveness. It's a harder thing to say, no, I'm going to pursue them. I love the phrasing here. I'm going to make the first move and I'm going to make things right. I think from where I sit, that's just a whole lot harder. Because what it requires me to do is, I think, and I this is the best way I can think about it, is that even if I think I'm only 20% at fault, I mean, let's think about a situation, like, think about a situation where you have somebody and you're like in conflict and you think like, it's probably 80% them and 20% me. I think what this is calling me to do is, even in that moment where we could so sit back and say, well, I'm justified to sit back and wait because I've just got the little thing and they've got the big thing, it requires me to say, hey, I've got this little part in it and I need to own my little part in it first. And I'm probably not going to get the reaction I want out of them, Jamie, right? I think what this requires of us is just this really harder thing. I think it looks like this. Can I just tell you, and I'm going to be really vulnerable and tell you my own failures, is that most of the time I'm content to let Jennifer say she's sorry first, because it's just so hard to say I'm sorry first, even when I've been the bigger jerk, and especially when I've been the lesser jerk. This is super, super hard stuff. And so it challenges me that if forgiving my enemies is the first step, the next step is, who have I done wrong? And what do I have to do to put things to right? A friend introduced me to this concept this way, and some of you that are familiar with AA will know this language. He talks to me about cleaning up my side of the street. The language, have you cleaned up your side of the street? The analogy is, you can't do anything about your neighbor's yard. You can't do anything about their trash. You can't do anything about the 80% they did wrong to you. But you can own your 20%. I was going to use an example this morning, and then Caleb was in the nursery. I was going to say, pretend Caleb comes in late, and he's past curfew, and on the way in, he leaves the lights on and the garage door open, and, you know, knocks the mirror off his car, or whatever, right? And he comes in, and I lose my cool with him, and I berate him, and I shame him, right? What this is saying is that even if he doesn't apologize to me, and even if he's clearly in the wrong, and I should say in this example, Caleb's always great about curfew. This is really theoretical, and he's not in here. But even if I still have to come back and own my part. Yeah, you were wrong, but I shouldn't have said what I said, though. And it doesn't mean in this passage, it doesn't mean that I have to wait. I don't wait for them. I don't wait for them to do it first. I own my part first. As fast as I become aware of my part, I own my part and step back. This idea, by the way, comes from AA directly. This is from the ninth step. For those of you that follow AA, you already know this. So step 9 is make direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. What this comes from is 8, and in step 8, we make a moral, an inventory of all the people we've wronged. And we get real honest about, I've wronged this person in this way and this person in this way, and here's my little piece here and here's my little piece there and here's my big piece over there. And what 9 does is 9 says, well, then you take that list and you start working through that list and you make amends. And sometimes those amends, and they talk about, if you do some of the reading in AA, the amends sometimes might be financial, it might be emotional, it might be verbal. There's a lot of different ways we might need to make amends to somebody. But making amends is even a step beyond asking forgiveness, but it's then what we're trying to teach our boys is it's one thing to ask forgiveness of somebody, but then how do you make it right? How do you make it right with that person so if you stole money from them, you pay it back? And I know that I'm opening like all kinds of Pandora's box here because there's all kinds of complicated, this all gets super, super complicated, except what I know is that we're all like knee deep in this stuff all the time. I was preparing for this, and I read an article on the New York Times, and it was about a gathering on the Upper West Side in New York like 2 or 3 years ago, and it was a packed room full of people, and this rabbi was talking about forgiveness, and he asked this question. He said, and I want to do it here, I'm curious. He asked the whole audience to identify in their family, first cousins and closer. First cousins and closer. So think about your family, first cousins and closer. And how many of you know a situation, first cousins and closer, where family members aren't speaking to each other? Yeah, same results in their room. About 2/3 of the room raised their hand. That's really close family. Family members that do not speak to each other. And now I know some of it's years of abuse and we don't let abusers get back at it, get that close to us and all that stuff. But some of them are just this stuff that we haven't cleaned our side of the street. And for me, for a while now, and I just want to say this is one of those moments as a preacher where it feels really uncomfortable to stand up here because I've got plenty of garbage in my yard to still clean up. And this journey is one of we become aware of something, and then when we become aware of it, we do it. And then what happens if you pay attention is you'll become aware of something else. And we became aware of something else. And I don't think there's ever some Shangri-La where I just say, like, my yard is perfect. I don't think that's actually a thing, unless you live next to my neighbor and his yard really is, I think, close to perfect. But for the rest of us, there's never a spot where I don't think any of us would say, like, nah, I have no weeds in my yard. We all have weeds. And so I started thinking about this, and I was working through, like, what does it mean to keep my side of the street clean? What does it mean to do what Jesus said and to go and seek the person out and to make amends? And so I started making a list, and it started as tips, and then it turned into like warnings. And so it's tips and warnings, and just a couple thoughts before we move to our practice for the week and then move to communion. I think I've said this already, but I think this is just harder than forgiving. It is easier. It's been easier in my experience to sit back and wait for somebody to humble themselves before me and tell me they're sorry and to forgive them. Because what happens in that moment is how do we feel when we forgive somebody? What's that? You lost? Yeah, you lost. What happens with me? I won. And often when we forgive somebody, I'll just say for me, the self-righteous meter kicks in, right? Anybody else? Like, I feel pretty good. Like, yep. In my graciousness, I will bestoweth upon thee mine forgiveness for the crimes that thou hast committed against me. Right? Yeah.
I was going to say, so often though, we forgive too soon.
Sure, absolutely. Absolutely. And especially when we're in close relationships, sometimes forgiveness is this journey of going back and back and back. And I know in my life that even when I've said to somebody, I forgive you, I have to keep going back and forgiving them. And I have to keep, and I don't keep telling them that because that'd be ridiculous. But I do. I have to keep coming back and say, oh yeah, I said I wouldn't hold on to that. Oh yeah, I'm not holding on to that. Oh yeah, like I have to keep, and you keep circling it. And just to say it doesn't always mean that it's done, for sure. Or because it's super awkward and we want the conversation to be over. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Don't love it. All right. Yeah, yeah, you're forgiven. Just let's stop talking about this. UMBC, right? Like, so, yeah, for sure. So I think this, where we start talking about keeping our own side of the street clean, this is harder. This is harder than forgiving my enemies. It requires me to own my stuff, even if I just had a little part in it. A second thought is that generic apologies don't count. I think we've said this many times in here. What am I looking at here? What's the apology I'm trying to get away from? I'm sorry for whatever I did. I'm sorry if I hurt you. I'm sorry. Basically, both of those things are kind of saying, like, I'm sorry if you have a problem. And you clearly do, right? That's the subtext, is you clearly have some problems, and I'm sorry that you have those problems. And we don't actually own the thing. What we're talking about here is, I'm trying to get better about this. And this is where, especially in relationship, we have to get better at listening so that we know what we're apologizing for. How have I hurt you? And sometimes when the person says, how have I hurt you? We're like, I don't want to apologize for that. And it takes a while. Like, we got to come back later and say, like, oh, okay, I'll own that one. And it's this process. It's this ongoing thing. Thirdly, people, this is Jamie's point, people rarely respond in kind. And I think we have to let that go. If you're going to own your 20%, 10%, 30%, whatever it is, if you're going to own that and you're going to enter into this kind of thing and you're going to do what Jesus talks about, where you're going to see an enemy and you're like, okay, I'm going to clean up my side of the street, we cannot walk into that expecting a particular kind of response out of that person. Because I'm just going to promise you right now, you will be disappointed. If you think that, hey, I mean, maybe somebody has had this experience where, hey, I went to somebody and I apologized for my small part and they burst forth in tears and owned all their stuff. I don't know what sitcom you're on. I want to get on that show because that's not really how it works most of the time. And I do believe reconciliation is possible, but usually it's a longer process. That might open the door to a longer conversation where it might soften them up and maybe they'll start owning bits and pieces of their stuff too. But I don't do it because that's why I'm doing it. It's not manipulation. It really is just this genuine following after Jesus. And if I'm going to keep my side of the street clean, I've got to own my 10, 20%, whatever I think it is. Just by the way, real side note, they probably also think that they have 10, 20% of the blame, right? Just so we're clear, we all think we have like 10 or 20%. Nobody sees this? If you don't see this, you should talk to your spouse, all right? Ask them about any given argument, how much of it is yours, how much is mine? And I think you'll both agree that you both had 10%, all right? At least that's probably true for us, all right? So, I think I said this one, right? You may not feel better. You may not have this kind of conversation and walk away feeling a whole lot better. Because oftentimes these kinds of things bring up stuff. And they make it just go deeper and harder. And especially when we know that to keep our side of the street clean, it requires a conversation. And I should say, sometimes keeping our side of the street clean isn't anything we have to say to somebody else. The AA point is that if we're going to harm somebody by our apology, we shouldn't say that to them. So maybe sometimes keeping our side of the street clean is just an internal thing, or maybe we work it out in AA, you work it out with a sponsor, but maybe we work it out with a trusted friend or a spouse or somebody like, hey, that person did me wrong and I'm going to let it go. And I don't think that having that conversation is helpful to the relationship. So I'm just going to choose to let it go, but I still have to do this, right? So, but that might not feel better immediately. It might take some time. Two more things. Move in accordance with the Spirit, not someone else's conscience. If we all live by other people's consciences, we'd be busy, right? So what I'm looking at here is somebody comes to you and says, well, you need to tell that person you're sorry. You need to tell that person you're sorry. You need to do that. No, I don't care about any of that. You need to move in step with the Spirit, and where the Spirit is saying, like, hey, here's something for you, you need to respond to that. And then move to the next thing. And then move to the next thing. And if this were true, what we would do here on Sunday mornings is at the end of the service, I'd have you each come to me and I'd tell you the stuff you needed to apologize to people for. And that's ridiculous. So part of this stuff is, especially during the season of Lent, getting quiet, getting slow enough, paying attention to my life, and asking, like, hey, is there somebody that I need to go and make it right? Is there somebody that I need to go and own my 20% so they can own their 20%? And then finally, I think I've said this too. You may be changed or not. Release expectations. This might just be the thing that starts you on the pathway to healing in this relationship. It really might. And it might not. I think one of the things I've been encouraged with and disappointed by both in my life is that when I look through all the pictures of Imago, some of them really make me sad. There was a picture Jennifer and I were looking at yesterday, and she's like, every person in that picture isn't here anymore. It was me and four guys sitting on that. For those of you that were back around in the Arcadia days, right out the back doors, there was a pew right against those open windows, and it was me and four guys sitting on a pew, and they're all gone. And I look at some of those situations and I think, well, I know my side of the street is clean, but that relationship's not coming back. Because I did this, it didn't fix it. But I got to tell you, there's others where it does. Jennifer and I last summer sat on our deck with a really good friend, and we had gone through a really hard season with this friend. And we had a real heart-to-heart. And I think our side of the street's clean, and it's really, really good. We've been restored to our friends, and things are as good as they've ever been. And I'm really thankful for that. And I know in my life I've had those stories too of people that, man, we had a season where it was ugly. For whatever reason, it got real ugly. And then we did this, and we owned our stuff. We took care of our sides of the street, and it worked out again. I just want to say to you, the tip and the warning here is you can't go into it with that kind of expectation, but you always go into it with that kind of hope. You always hope that that's what's going to be true. I want you to take out your notes. This is our last week of Lent as a church because next week is the anniversary, and so we won't be doing Lenty things next week. And so I want you to look at the back of your notes, and it says for reflections. And these are conversations for your small groups or for friends or maybe even just for you to process and maybe give the Spirit space to work. Is there forgiveness that needs granted or asked for today? How might I demonstrate God's love for this person? How will I make time to pray for somebody I resent today? That's hard enough. What will I pray for that individual? So those are things for you to, in your quiet spaces, to think through, to process, talk about with somebody if you really need to. And then here's the invitation, is to choose this week to pursue forgiveness, take responsibility for your part in the conflict, make amends if possible, acknowledge where you are on the path to restoration, and take one more step. Listen, I feel like, and maybe this isn't true, but I really do feel like this is some of the hardest stuff. And I think that given the raise of hands earlier, this is the stuff we live in all the time. That we all probably, if we give any space to this for any minute, we can think of somebody where we need to make amends. And some of it may be big historical, this has been happening for years kind of stuff. And some of it might just be like, hey, we had a rough day yesterday and I need to go to my spouse and make amends. Some of it might be that. I think they're all important. And I think dealing with the small stuff and keeping my street clean and the small stuff is a way to not have the big stuff, right? And it's part of good marriage maintenance. It's part of good friendship maintenance. It's part of good family maintenance. Like, we should be doing that frequently. And so I hope that I'm going to give you a space here in just about a minute of silence and as we move towards communion for you just to maybe ask that question. Who is it? Where do I need to make amends? What do I need to say? How do I need to own my side of the street? Even if I think they were mostly to blame, how do I need to apologize to Caleb for the part I played? Yeah, I yelled. I shouldn't have lost my cool. He was 90% wrong, still lost my cool. Does that make sense? So let's do that. Let's just move towards silence. And I want you to, if you need to write on that paper, you can write on it. But I would guess for most of you, you don't need to write. You know who you're talking about. You know who you're thinking about this whole sermon. You know who you've been thinking about. And so I want you just to sit with that for a little bit. And in about a minute, I'll pray and we'll move towards communion. Jesus, I feel like such a fraud standing up today talking about this kind of stuff because I'm so bad at it myself and I'm still always working out my own stuff. But I think we're all in the same boat on this one. We screw up in relationships all the time and people screw up with us all the time and we're in a constant battle of choosing forgiveness and choosing to ask for forgiveness. And so I pray that this morning you give us the courage and the insight and the ability to keep our sides of the street clean. Help us to know what we need to own without being crazy and manic and owning everything. Help us to be wise in what we need to own and then dealing with the stuff that we need to own. And then I give results to you. It's so good when we can be restored to somebody that we love. And yet, also at the same time, I can't control that. And so help us to have open hands to whatever comes. And I pray that as we do this in community, give us wisdom. Help us to know when we get to spaces with each other and we're trying to help each other know, help us to be wise in our discernment, wise in our advice giving, to listen well, and help us to spur each other on to love and good works. In your name I pray, amen.